right now in studio, Domenica Persani, Chief Executive Officer of Bracebridge Hall, Earlville, Maryland, which treats various addictions. I did a live broadcast from there, it seems like eons ago. I guess it was two springs ago, as I recall. And honestly, the most difficult hurdle for me was finding your location. I passed it several times there, Domenica, and finally got to it after getting instructions from two people. The final person was in a liquor store there.
Oh,
that's how I found there. I found there was a little ironic, you know, liquor addiction. Course. But anyway, it's very peaceful in your campus area.
It is. It is. Beautiful site. It is a little difficult to find. We're on almost, 600 acres of land in Earlville, Maryland, in Cecil County.
Is there a story? How'd you end up there?
So it's interesting. It used to be the MBNA Corporate Retreat Center.
Ah.
That's what Bracebridge was. So our CEO, when they were looking for property, actually looked at it as like a residential property. And then, saw the site, saw that it was the Corporate Retreat Center, and, determined that it would be a beautiful place, very peaceful, very serene, where someone could come, who was suffering, sick and suffering from addiction, right? And then have this beautiful place and surroundings where they could recover.
And this is when MBNA was selling off because it was closing some of its operations?
Yeah, and then the building was the mansion. That's what we all call it, right? It was a residential mansion prior to MBNA.
Yeah, it looks like a mansion.
Yeah, prior to MBNA owning it, it was a residential property. So, it sat vacant for a little while before we obtained it as well.
Now, do people just normally park by it, or you use a kind of a trolley shuttle all the time, or both?
So a little bit of both. So when people come, to our site, I guess when you were there, it was probably right before we opened the new building. It was when we were opening the new building. So now there's a parking lot in the front, and there's about 80 parking spots.
It's a little easier to get to it, unless you have a lot going on.
Yeah, because that driveway is about 2 miles from where, you used to park originally.
So. Well, let me ask what I regard as a central question. I mean, when the opioid crisis began, it got scant coverage in the popular media. And then all of a sudden, it was almost like, Houston, we have a problem here. But that took several years and a lot of human suffering and deaths before it really got national attention. Now, of course, there's an investigative piece nearly every day about some group or some company has been implicated, Walgreens, disproportionately distributing opioids, having its own central center. So has all the publicity been a good thing or kind of a mixed blessing? Let me ask you, Domenica.
Yeah, so that's a good question. I view it a little bit as a double-edged sword, right? So, if you go back, years back, so 2005, I've been working in the field about 21 years. So back 2005, you had a lot of individuals that were coming in. If you had to, put a percentage on it, when I worked in treatment then, about 80% of the people that were seeking treatment for opiate dependence were coming in for heroin. About 20% were prescription drug use. Within about 3 years, so to 2008, 2009, that number flipped exactly. We had about 80% coming in prescription drugs, and then, about 20% for heroin, right? So we put this huge, big emphasis on prescription drug prescribing, and then, we put in the prescription drug monitoring program, and, Delaware implemented that, many, many other states. And then all of a sudden, now we're closing down pain management doctors who were prescribing irresponsibly. That's a great thing. The problem was the state didn't have the capacity to then treat all the people that were addicted to pain meds.
So the pendulum swings and there's sometimes an overreaction.
And then we went from, most of the treatment centers in the state of Delaware in particular doubled their numbers. And when I say overnight, it was literally overnight. For us, in the outpatient program that I worked in formerly, we went from 8 to 10 admissions a day to 10 to 16 admissions a day, literally overnight, because they shut 4 pain management docs down one day and then, 3 the next week. And those patients were left out with nowhere to go, and a lot of them with no understanding of what was happening to them because they weren't educated properly around what the opioids were doing to their system.
Well, surely, unless they just are buried in a hole, they must know from the news, or are still some impervious to the whole deal?
So, there's a little story that I like to share with people because I think it's important to answer that question. So, one, I think that people aren't always informed and educated properly, but more than that, I think we trust our doctors. right? So I've been in this field 21 years. I'm in long-term recovery. And my son had knee surgery, tore his meniscus, and he tore his ACL. Major surgery.
And in pain.
He's 18 years old at the time. And I had a doctor tell me he needed 3 different opiates after his surgery for, a week. So much.
When was this?
It's not been a year. So 10 months, about 10 months ago.
Okay, go on.
And so much so, the conversation with the doctor, again, I'm an educated and I speak all over the country about this. I've been in the field forever. And this doctor had me questioning my decision to not allow my son to take those meds. So much so that I called my medical director that I work with. And I said, am I crazy? Like, he's saying that I'm going to need this and that. It was on a Friday. He said, if I don't take this script and my son wakes up in pain on Sunday afternoon, there's going to be nothing that I'm going to be able to do. And he said to me, your child's going to suffer because of your fear and paranoia. That's what he said to me. Now, mind you, phenomenal surgeon, great doctor, very well respected. So if they can make someone like me who has this experience and background question it and feel intimidated, right?
Well, is the doctor aware of your profession?
So the interesting part was when we went, I told him what I did, right? And he said that contributed to my paranoia. But when we went back for the follow-up, I said to him, I'm just really confused and I'm curious, what made you push, that hard? And it was interesting. So he said to me, I'm a doctor and we manage pain. That's my job. My job is to keep my patients comfortable. And so I think a lot of times we place a lot of blame, right? And we say, the docs do this and the docs do that. And we forget that we all have a job, right? And part of their job is to manage pain. And so you have to find the ones that are doing it responsibly.
Well, what about something short of opioids, which is the second most effective means of controlling pain without being as addictive?
Sure. I mean, and that's what we should be talking about, right? We should be talking about anything holistic that works, any type of non-narcotic pain med. But people don't like pain, right?
Of course, it doesn't help that Tylenol, which is obviously not nearly as effective, but can be used. There's a story just now about some cancer link. I mean, you can't win.
Yes.
So then you got to look at disproportional pros and cons. But for example, I underwent surgery earlier this year, major surgery. Actually, 2 surgeries, and I have another one coming up in December. I've been given pain meds. I'm woefully afraid to take them. I've been in pain literally when I've been on the air here. I haven't taken anything. Yep. Maybe I'm overreacting the other way, but I'm so fearful. I mean, how addictive are these things if you are well-informed, in your opinion?
Yeah, so, you run a risk anytime you're taking a pain med, right? You run a risk of dependence. So, you hear stories about people who took pain, 18, 19, 20-year-old kids who took pain meds for, 1 week, come off a 7-day script, and next thing you know, they're searching for pain meds, right? And so much of that is what was present.
Is it to eliminate pain, or is it also because of a euphoric feeling that some people feel when they use all kinds of drugs?
And
or a little bit of both?
A little bit of both, and also what was present prior, right? Do you have a person who suffers from depression? They don't even know that they suffer from depression, and then they take opiate med, or whatever, benzos, whatever. And next thing you know, all those feelings that they felt go away, and they're whoa.
As you may know from your son, these days when you have surgery, you're the patient and the guardian or whatever are asked all kinds of questions, and it's interesting how many times it is about depression. Maybe that's the reason. Right.
And so that it's that combo of, the perfect storm, right, is what leads to addiction and dependence, right? It's when opportunity and availability line up, right? And that's what happens. So you have somebody who may not even know that they're predispositioned or that they're higher risk, and next thing you know.
And there is some evidence, is there not, as when so many things, different human beings respond in different ways. And some people may have a higher pain tolerance than others. Some may be better equipped to get off something that delivered some pleasurable feelings than others, and so on.
For sure.
Right,
because and we don't know what those correlations are, right? We have a lot of data and research that shows a lot of things, but what we don't know a lot of is why certain people end up with dependency and other people don't, right? Why can some people go out and have a drink, 3 nights a week, 4 nights a week, and never have a dependence or go through any type of withdrawal, but someone else, they go out and for 4 weeks they have a drink 3 nights a week, and next thing you know, they're binge drinking and they're drinking every day, and then they end up, you know, with dependence, right? And so, you know, a lot of it, we believe, you know, environmental cause, you have your, you know, genetics, right? Your family, when you're raised in a household, you know, with an alcoholic or someone who's addicted, all those things increase trauma. I mean, trauma is the biggest indicator for addiction. So, you know, all those things can point us.
What do you mean by trauma?
So, you know, there's some data that shows that people who come in for addiction treatment, anywhere between 70 to 80% of them have experienced some sort of significant trauma in their life. So trauma can also be objective, right? So what I view as a trauma, you might experience, and it may not have any impact on you at all, right? So for example, a 10-year-old witnesses a car accident. That may be extremely traumatizing to me, and you may witness a car accident at 10 and not think anything of it the rest of your life, right? But a lot of times it's more significant traumas, right? It's abandonment. They say homelessness is the number one traumatic experience for individuals.
Well, which creates a vicious circle, obviously, all the substance abuse and everything. How do you get a job and get out of homelessness? Right. Becomes an incredible vicious circle, a vortex. For people joining us here at the quarter hour, 1115 Delaware, in-studio guest Domenica Persanti, Chief Executive Officer, Bracebridge Hall, which is in Earlville, Maryland. Just a beautiful, beautiful campus in a rural setting. I mean, you can go outside and take a nap, and it would be beautifully quiet and all. The only thing is finding the place.
Yes.
But I digress again. Okay, well, and I should point out, we'll have a further update on the impeachment hearing in the House of Representatives, first public hearing with Peter MacArthur, bottom of the hour, CBS News, 11:30, another one at 12. Any bulletins we'll have. Let's get to now what your facility is doing. Just what you've observed. How long have you been there?
So I've been with Recovery Centers of America for 3 years. I've been at Bracebridge Hall a little over two.
All right. Have you noted even in two or three short years changes in people coming in, changes in recommended treatments, changes in trends, or is it more from the literature and talking to colleagues you get a better idea over a decade or more?
Yeah, so I think all the above. So as far as, you know, the populations that come into treatment, you know, I think anymore there is no specific look or stereotype of someone who suffers from addiction. There just isn't. I mean, in my facility, we have lawyers, doctors, first responders. We have individuals who are homeless. We have 18-year-old athletes. I mean, we treat pregnant women. There's no rhyme or reason to what our trends
are. So although we mentioned the vicious circular situation for a homeless person, we would be mistaken to think it's only homeless people or near homeless. It's across the socioeconomic spectrum.
And high numbers of, you know, like white collar professionals, right? Individuals who are just your average day to day people that are suffering from addiction. There's no indicator.
Is there a different pattern now as to the ones who were treated with opioids who end up there? For example, you kind of hinted at it with your own son. I mean, maybe a family doctor is much more hesitant to prescribe, but a surgeon much less so.
Right. So I think that when we started to put the prescription drug monitoring programs into place across the country, I think that that caused some unintended consequences, good and bad, right? So, you know, we increased the amount of hours that doctors now have for continuing education, right, in addiction. When this all first took off, I mean, it was like the requirement was like three. I remember talking to doctors who would say, my entire medical career, I got 3 or 6 hours of addiction treatment. But if you ask primary care docs, they'll tell you that anywhere from 40 to 60% of the people that they're serving have some sort of addiction challenge, whether it's, you know, sporadic use or whether it's, you know, a dependence. And then when you look at co-occurring, when you look at people who suffer from depression, anxiety in combination with addiction, that number goes up to 70%.
Yeah.
So if you think about that, right, our docs get 6 hours of training in medical school, right? And then the CEUs, there weren't any requirements up until we started to put the prescription drug monitoring
CEUs.
In place for ongoing continuing, you know, credit in addiction. Now there are. But even still, you're still talking about 3-6 hours, right?
Well, what is your experience? Is an addictive personality addictive in many ways? I don't mean to be trite or trivial here, but for example, someone who's addicted to social media and getting likes, that person is more likely to be addicted. And otherwise, oh no, there's no rhyme or reason. One is addicted to one thing and not another, and there's no common inclination, or maybe with a few people there is.
So I can say that, you know, in my experience in the field, a lot of times when you take one addiction away, something else will then present itself. So like, for example, at my facility, one of the things that we had to address 6 or 8 months ago was all of a sudden we had a lot of people that were ordering from Amazon. And we're looking at it going, why do we have all these packages coming in? You had people who are, you know, they're out of their detox, they're in treatment, and now they're shopping, right?
Dare I say, so you have a relationship and your friend or significant other, spouse, suddenly you got them out of drinking so much, and all of a sudden they're ordering all kinds of things.
Gambling is another one that seems to pop itself up, especially now because you can do that through social media.
I mean, does your facility address those addictions too, to some extent?
Absolutely. So, I mean, we treat addiction across the board. So, obviously, they come in with a substance use addiction, and we treat co-occurring mental health disorders as well.
What is the most common addiction after substance abuse, which including drugs and alcohol?
So, we see a lot of individuals. I mean, so relationships. I mean, one of the biggest triggers that we see for relapse in individuals who are in recovery and who are going through this process, relationships are such a big trigger, and they are addictive, right? Other humans and the feelings we get from other humans become addictive, especially when we're sober, right? So when you talk about...
Is that because of breakups, or one cannot function without a significant other? Or?
Codependency is so common in this disease, right? So, and I'm talking about relationships in general, not just romantic relationships, right? So
in the office, family.
How many parents, right, do you come across... And you'll, outsider looking in, you'll listen to this person tell their story, and they'll say, you know, their son lives at home. They know their son's using. They're paying for gas. They're giving the individual.
So we're talking about enablers, too.
I mean, so.
Will you bring them in and counsel them?
Absolutely. So our program addresses the family as a unit because we don't believe that an individual is going to be able to maintain any long-term sobriety without a support system. And that may not always be, you know, their formal family, right? That may not be the person who gave birth to them and raised them. They may not have that. They may have burned all those bridges.
So what is your feeling about AA or other movements where people come and chat with people, or you replicate that at your facility as well?
So we have on-site meetings daily, 7 days a week, where we bring in AA and NA. We also have something called J Groups through the Journey Church in Newark. So the Journey comes down once a week. We also take our patients to church. Our spiritual component is infused in everything
that
we do.
That's okay, although you're a public facility.
Absolutely. So everybody has the option, right?
Yeah.
But we are built on the premise.
Yeah.
And everything that we do, the 12 steps are infused, and we have spiritual advisor on staff.
I mean, but what do you do with a very insular person, a very inward looking person who really doesn't want to spill out his or her dirty laundry in a group? I mean, there's got to be people like that. Maybe they're salvageable anyway.
Absolutely.
But they don't profit from that situation.
So one of the things we pride ourselves on at Bracebridge is that we are not cookie cutter, right? So from the time someone hits the front door, everything we do, they are the driver of their treatment in collaboration with our treatment team. So everything that they do is everything we do for them. It's all customized, right? So there's no like you come in and you get this prescriptive, you know, services that like we don't do that, right? So we figure out what they need and we tailor their treatment to them. It's the only way people are successful. If we give everybody the same exact thing, everything doesn't work for everybody.
Before you started what you do, what were you doing? What brought you to this career?
So I've been in this field as long as I can remember. So I worked retail before I worked in this field.
Pray tell, doing what?
I worked at the mall. Like I sold.
Christiana?
I did. And Concord.
Okay.
Yeah, all types of retail, right? I was a server for years.
So was it seeing some people with addictions or what that you made this twist in your life?
A lot of close encounters, you know? So I was 14 years old the first time I was in treatment. So
you've been in treatment.
Yeah. So, you know, for me, it was near and dear to my heart. But
may I ask for what?
Originally, you know, for me it started. So this is the chicken before the egg, right? Was it mental health or was it addictions? So for me originally, you know, was like mental health treatment, right? And, you know, things spiraled out for me, you know, when I was 19 and 20 years old. And, you know, I had a child, was not a good parent, was just running, you know, rampant, wreaking havoc on everyone and everything. And, you know, I had people, and I tell people all the time, if it hadn't been for the grace of others, I wouldn't be where I am today, right? I had people save me. I had a probation officer who said, you know, you're worth more. You should go to school. You should do something with it. And I was like, go to college. Like, I was awful in school. Like, I barely made it out of school. They graduated me to get me out, right?
Not to give you an excuse, but you kind of got moved around and such. Yeah. I often think that's unsettling for someone's sure. academic career.
For sure, you know, and so I, you know, got into the criminal justice system at 17, stayed in the criminal justice system for years. You know, I wreaked a lot of havoc, right? So for me, having someone who said, you know, you're worth more, you deserve more, go to college.
Yeah, at the time, that was inconceivable. Let me ask quickly, then we got a break, and we'll get more into how people get admitted to your facility to begin with. But, you know, so often we hear about employers are very hesitant to hire someone with a record in prison, whatever it was, although increasingly there's acceptance of low-level marijuana usage or whatever. I think in your career, though, it's probably a great plus to have had personal experience so you can empathize more with people, right?
For sure. Yeah. So, yeah, we'll talk a little bit about that when we come from.
All right. Coming back here, Del Aware and Domenica Parati, Chief Executive Officer, Bracebridge Hall, Earlville, Maryland, with us here on Del Aware.